Hi, this is the Moving Toward Inclusive Practice podcast, a production of the Military Families Learning Network's Family Transitions Concentration Area. I'm Bob Birch. Over the next several episodes of the podcast, we'll be talking with Dr. Ann Phibbs about how we can become more culturally competent as helping professionals and move toward a more inclusive practice. Ann is the founder and president of Strategic Diversity Initiatives and brings over 25 years experience helping organizations advance their equity, diversity, and inclusion goals. Our conversations with Dr. Phibbs will focus on five spheres of cultural competence: seeking out stories, practicing humility, listening, asking questions, and engaging with others. In this episode, we'll be talking about seeking out stories. So let's start our journey together. We're so glad to have you with us, and we're glad as well to welcome Dr. Ann Phibbs to the podcast. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Why do you think cultural competence is important for helping professionals?
Well, cultural competence is important. It's actually essential. If you don't pay attention to the ways that your own social identities, so this is your race, your gender identity, sexual orientation, disability, class, nationality, religion, these social identities, they impact how we see the world. They impact the biases that we have. And so if we're coming into contact with people, whether we're trying to help clients or working with coworkers out in the community, and we're often inadvertently showing up with some bias, with some microaggressions or micro inequities, or some ways that we put people off or aren't as inclusive as we could be, that's really what cultural competence is about, is recognizing that we're not all neutral, we're not all universal, that, you know, the people who say, I don't see race, it's a nice idea, but in fact, all the research around implicit bias shows we do in fact see race, we make decisions based on it. We do see gender, and we might not see it correctly, but we perceive it and make decisions based on that. So what it means is we're not making the best decisions, and the research bears that out as well. So wrapping back to my original point, if we want to do our jobs well, which I assume everyone does, whether that's, you know, again, serving a military family, helping a coworker with a project, being part of a team, the biases, the sometimes explicit but often implicit bias gets in the way of seeing things for how they really are, of building, you know, kind of capital, human capital. We don't build each other. We don't develop each other. We don't create the most effective teams. And research bears that out as well, that, in fact, diverse teams fare better in all sorts of situations. So cultural competence is, I would say, becoming kind of the minimum, the best practice, really, for doing anything, any kind of work. I'm going to argue in anything, certainly in the helping professions. Mm-hmm. It's best practice.
Right. You mentioned sort of our view of the world. How do the stories that were told throughout our lives in our own cultures shape that view?
Right. Well, it's interesting, when I was looking at the title and thinking about what I wanted to say, it was tempting to focus on stories, and I realized I wanted to kind of focus on the notion of seeking out. And the reason being that if we don't seek out alternative stories, then we're left with what we've been told. And I want to give a great resource here, a TED Talk by the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I think I said that correctly. She's a very, you know, well-known, talented writer, and she has a wonderful TED Talk called The Danger of a Single Story. And she talks about how I like how she says, it's not that a stereotype is necessarily wrong, it's that it's incomplete, that what we have is a single story of someone. So she tells the story of coming to the U.S. for college and having a roommate who didn't know much about Nigeria, much less, didn't know much about Africa, much less Nigeria, and assumed that Chimamanda Adichie didn't know how to use a stove and said, can I listen to your tribal music? And she says, yeah, she was, she was taken aback when I pulled out a tape of Mariah Carey, right? Mm-hmm. So she's this middle-class Nigerian who has all these assumptions. And she said, she'd seen me through one lens, through one story, a single story. And so And the problem with folks who are marginalized, so these are people of color, Native people, people who are LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, women, people with marginalized identities, people with disabilities, is that two things. There's two problems with the way that stereotypes work, these notion of stories or lenses, if you will, like how we see people, is that we often have negative stereotypes and stories that we've been told, and we allow ourselves to be we allow it to be the tape that's running in our head. So we see someone who's homeless on the street, and we have a story about them. We have a story about maybe what happened to them, but also depending on their race, depending on other kinds of factors about them, we make up stories. And then we see a white man walk in the door wearing a suit and tie. And I was talking with I often talk with stories, so I was talking with a group of lawyers, and there was one lawyer who was particularly well-dressed, you know, a lot of them were, but he said, I wear a suit and tie everywhere I go. I said, why? He said, because I get treated better. And he was a white man. So there's a story, I think, when I kind of do my own introspection, which is what we can all do, and we're really honest with each other, right, with ourselves, rather. They don't have to do this with anyone else initially. Just say, when I see a man, a white man in a suit and tie, what are my stereotypes? And my stereotypes are, he's a good person. He's responsible. He's probably disciplined. He's, right? And then I have to remind myself about white collar crime and the fact that one can be wearing a suit and tie and be a white man and not be a good human being. And one can be a profoundly good human being and be homeless. Be a profoundly good person who is living in poverty. Be a profoundly good person who is unemployed or underemployed. But the story part comes from that's not what we've been told. Mm-hmm. And stories don't just come from our families, although they do. They come from the media. They come from when we look at some of the research around women in leadership, and we see that everyone, including women, have a bias against women leaders. Well, it's no surprise, because for most of us who grew up, who did we ever see as president? Well, we've never had a female president. I just think I saw that, gosh, what percentage, I should know this, what percentage of the 100 senators are female, but it's certainly not 50%, mm-hmm. right? None of our elected officials, for the most part, not governors, not state legislatures or national legislature, the Congress reflects the actual gender diversity in our country in terms of, if we just look around, men and women. Of course, there's much more gender diversity than that. But, so, we've been I want to give another shout out to another TED Talk, because there's such great opportunities for education. And they're all captioned, which I love, which is great. Kristen Pressner, Pressner, is the head of HR at Roche Diagnostics. And she does a TED Talk called I'm Biased, Are You? I can't quite remember. But if you Google her name, you'll find it. And one of the things she talks about is, you know, she explains implicit bias. And she talks about how, you know, our brain, we know this from neuroscience, that our brains take shortcuts. And so we go to those shortcuts that are the story we were always told, the story in the media, that, that you know, white people are to be believed, and that the criminality of people of color, or that if I think about my own community, the LGBTQ community, I was talking about how strong the stereotype is that we're not to be trusted with children. And that is slowly changing as more and more of us have kids. But I was doing a training, and I'm 56, openly lesbian, and I have three children, and I was talking about that. And after the training, a gay man in roughly the same age range as me came up, and he said, I'm really glad you talked about, because I was talking in the training about the message I got from my mother about when I came out to her. She said, I'm sorry, you'll never have kids, just assuming gay people don't have kids. So he came up to me and he said, I'm so glad you told that story, because he said, to this day, and he's a professor, full professor, to this day I'm nervous when I'm around children, because the stereotype was so powerful growing up that as a gay man I would hurt children, right? So we internalize these stories. They impact us. We know from all the implicit bias research that we are likely to, when presented with identical resumes, what one is male and one is female, we rate the male resume as the male candidate as more competent, more hireable. Same thing, we all people of all races show a pro-white and anti-black bias. There's a bias against people who are known or suspected to be gay. There's a bias against people with disabilities. And so that comes from the stories. these very damaging kind of single stories that are negative. And the reverse also happens, that then the story is if you don't have those identities for it. So what do I mean by that reverse story? That anyone who's heterosexual automatically keeps children safe. Well, we know for a fact that's not true, right? And so what happens is we also tend to find what we look for. So if I'm looking for criminal behavior with people of color, guess what? I'll find criminal behavior with people of color. In fact, all the studies show that there's just as much, if not more, criminal behavior on the part of white people, for example, around drug use. But we don't look for it. Mm-hmm. So we don't find it. And so these are ways that the stories create the bias and kind of perpetuate the bias. So what do you do about it? The goal then is to, I think, start with what's that tape playing in your head? So start to notice things that, because we all do it. I don't think you can get rid of it. I don't think you just all of a sudden say, I'm going to work really hard and this is my year of getting rid of implicit bias. I don't think that's possible. But A, we don't have to act out of it. And B, we can challenge it in ourselves and others. And the more we notice it, the quicker we'll notice it. So we start to say, yep, I see someone walking toward me. I know I'm supposed to be scared. I don't need to be scared, right? I speak this as a white woman and what I've been taught around people of color. Another great book, and I can't remember his name, but the name is Whistling Vivaldi, and it's an African-American provost. I think he might have been working in Columbia at the time. The title comes, do you know this book? The title comes from how he would whistle Vivaldi walking down the street to make white people less scared of him. He said, I'm going to whistle something that white people don't associate. They associate as safe, as a white thing, this mm-hmm. classical music, right? So the other piece of this work is then realizing, look at the effort he has to put in to live his life. Right, he has to put in this extra effort to come across as safe to people. This white lawyer I was talking to, he's not worried about it. He puts on his suit and tie and he's going to walk in anywhere. He's going to assume to be, again, competent, financially responsible, trustworthy, when for all I know, he could be none of those things.
Right.
One last thing, and I just keep riffing, but I love podcasts, and I sometimes listen to these kind of true crime type podcasts. And there are a couple podcasts about these people. One is called Dirty John, another one who the blank, I won't say the word, is Hamish, about these con men, right? And one of the things I think about is how much easier it is to con people if you're white, right? That if some of these people had been people of color, had been people who grew up in poverty, but they're good looking, they come across as upper or middle class, they're white men. And so they come in with all this capital, and then they do horrible things to people, right? So they should be held accountable. But right. What's interesting is how we give the benefit of the doubt. And if you take all of that and you wrap that into, put that into the workplace, then you realize, what am I bringing into my team meeting? What am I bringing into my meetings with my colleagues? And how am I connected with my clients, right? So what are my client doesn't show up for a meeting for the third time, right? What's the story I tell myself? And does it matter what race they are, what gender they are, whether they're a parent? I mean, do I, and how's that related to my own kind of what I was taught mm-hmm. about responsibility and what that's supposed to look like? Anyway, I'm not going to give you many options to say no. questions because I just go.
No, it makes me think of a book by Dave Gray called Liminal Thinking, which is about sort of the layers that get built on top of each other that
right.
lead to what we think is some, you know, fact-based
yep.
opinion, but in fact is built up from our beliefs and our selective experience, not our real experience
right.
necessarily, but the experience that we choose to remember.
Exactly. Right.
And it kind of gets that idea about what you were saying about the stories we tell ourselves. Recognizing that is not always, I shouldn't say not always, it's not reality. It's our own perception of reality, and being cognizant of that, I think might help us get to what you're talking about, of being aware of our biases
right.
and where those stories come from.
Right, absolutely. And the first step is that recognition. The next step, if we're thinking about kind of building our cultural competence or capacity for that is how do I start to have those conversations with other people? It becomes really important. So when I go into the situation thinking, there's a really big difference to go into your workplace saying, I work really hard to be unbiased. I'm respectful with everyone. I don't think I will show bias. And if anyone calls me out, you know, my kind of initial response is to be defensive. And that doesn't get us very far. If I walk into a workplace and say, of course I'm biased, everyone is, it will show up. I wish it wouldn't, but it will, because that's how it works. I hope that I notice, but if I don't notice it, or I don't stop it, or I act out of bias, I really hope that I work with colleagues who in a caring, respectful manner can point that out to me, and I can do the same. And in fact, that's exactly what every supervisor, every team leader, every manager should be saying to their team is, this is who we need to be. And I'm in it too. There's no one who's not in it. So your diversity person doesn't get a pass. Your person of color and your colleague, right? I, as a lesbian, don't get a pass. I might say something biphobic. I might say something transphobic. I might say something homophobic, even though I'm lesbian, right? And how can someone call me out or call me in to a conversation and say, hey, I saw this happen. I don't, you know, we all do it, but this is a learning opportunity. And I talk about how it's kind of cheesy to say it this way, but it truly is a gift when someone takes the time and energy and risk, emotional risk. There's always emotional risk when you call someone in or call someone out. But it's a gift when someone says, hey, I want to share this with you because it's going to, you know, basically help you be a better person. But we don't do that too often. What we do is, if we look at how we deal with, for example, when white people commit acts of racism in the U.S. society, what happens? We inevitably, in the public eye, think about Governor Northam in Virginia. So here you have a medical school yearbook and a picture of the Ku Klux Klan. Doesn't get much more racist than that, and blackface. And then you have the very first response of white people over and over again is, I'm not racist. When part of you is like, really? Because I don't know about you, but the Ku Klux Klan is a racist image. And you put it in your yearbook. So did you commit a racist act? In fact, yes, you did. And a lot of white people, if not all white people, will at some point in their life, because that's what we've been taught. That's not the most important thing. The most important thing really is, what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. But when we stand up and we get all our black friends or colleagues and stand behind us and say, I'm not racist, we've not advanced the conversation. We've not modeled any kind of vulnerability. And once again, and it's not, you know, of course, people of color over there saying, yep, here we go again. You're not racist. You did something racist, which you won't atone for or talk about or barely even apologize for. But instead, we'll make it all about you and whether you're a racist. And so how do we build a community where we go into it saying, of course I'm biased. You know, I say as a white person, am I racist? I don't want to be, but I was raised in a country that is. So it's in me. So my I always say, don't judge me by where I started. Judge me by where I'm headed and where I end up. And in that respect, I say, I want to be on a journey to be unbiased toward all of these social identities, including the ones I myself carry. So, you know, I walk off a plane and I see a female pilot and that little girl from 1967 who's 5 years old who's been taught that men are the ones who can do things. There's that little voice in me that's like, female pilot. Well, goodness sake, I'm a feminist. I have a PhD. Of course I think women can fly planes. But I don't beat myself up for it. I say, oh, I have a close friend I knew at the, she's no longer at the U of M, but I love it. She would talk about her inner sexist. She would say, yes, I have an inner sexist or an inner racist. And it was this way to make it like still important. Not, she's not trying to minimize it, but she's trying to make it manageable in that way of like, this is something I can work on. When we have the racist hang over white people like this, the worst thing they could ever be called, we'll never have an open and honest discussion about race. The same thing with what we're seeing now with the Me Too movement with men. So men are kind of freaked out. Oh my gosh, I had this man in a training say, I have a buddy, and when his supervisees who are female, when they come to talk to him, he leaves the door open, right? he said, do you think that's a good idea? I said, well, it means that those women don't get to have a private conversation with their boss because of the actions of men. So, no, I don't think it's a good idea. But, oh, but he's worried. And I'm like, yeah, now you're feeling what women have always felt. Mm-hmm. So part of this work is to shift that kind of vulnerability.
We talk about the sphere of seeking out stories for this episode, and I wonder how important, or can that really get us out of that mindset? So part of it is being aware, right? Being aware of the stories that we've told ourselves. Is there any benefit in seeking out different stories?
Yeah, all the time. That's why I kind of mentioned I was focused on the seeking. I'm not sure I talked about that as much as I could. You know, it's important when a story presents itself to take that seriously. But if we're not careful, we live in, you know, we all live in somewhat in bubbles to some degree. We tend to live with and interact with friendship circles and family circles, often where there's not as much diversity as there could be. Or if there is diversity, it doesn't get talked about, right? Mm-hmm. So there's gay Uncle Larry, but nobody talks about it kind of thing. Or, and so what happens is, well, again, the story might not come into that circle. The counter, the kind of, the story that counteracts our narrative, right? So, for example, we have a narrative that everyone is born male or female. They stay that way their whole lives. They never change. And they're comfortable and in what we assign them at birth. And for most families, that's the narrative. And until someone comes in with a different narrative, that cousin who's transgender or that, you know, uncle who identifies as non-binary, then suddenly that starts to push on that narrative. Well, what if we don't have a family where that person comes in?
Right.
Right? So I sometimes say to workplaces, don't wait till your trans employee shows up. Don't wait till someone who's non-binary walks in the door. Think about the forms you're using, do they all ask for male and female? Think about if you have all gender restrooms or if all your restrooms are gendered. Think about, you know, have you had conversations as a staff about how to use pronouns and ask for pronouns and be respectful around pronouns and that kind of thing. And so that's that notion of seeking out an alternative reality, seeking out a different story and saying, okay, this is the story I was brought up with that, you know, I'm just thinking about some of the experiences I've had. There were two Hmong women who shared, one Hmong woman who was in her workplace, and she shared that with another Hmong woman, they're speaking Hmong. And a white colleague came up and said, oh, are you talking about me? In this very nasty way, and very terribly arrogant way, too, which is like highly unlikely they're talking about you. But now they will be, right, now that you said that. But at any rate, thinking about kind of, you know, what's my expectation around language around me, right? What will it be like if someone speaks different languages around me? Or do I expect that everyone in the United States will always speak English? And we've seen some videos of these people going off on someone in a store speaking Spanish, right? Mm-hmm. These are people who haven't taken in another story, another way of thinking. And haven't clearly had the experience, quite likely, of speaking a different language in a different context and what that feels like, right? Whether when they're traveling or living in another country, right? Or another part of the U.S. Mm-hmm. That so how do we use alternative stories, or not alternative, but stories different than our own? And the thing is, you know, if I was talking about this 50 years ago and you had to go to a library, that's a lot more challenging. And quite honestly, when I was growing up, that's what you had options to, or that was what was available. Now, pull out your computer and every day for the next month, take 15 minutes to find a video. I mean, I can think of all these. I often go to TED Talks, partly because they're captioned. There's another wonderful one by Maysoon Zayid, Zayid, and her title of her TED Talk is, I have 99 problems, palsy is just one. So she's a woman of color who lives with cerebral palsy, and it's a wonderful TED Talk. And for anyone for whom being a person of color living with a disability is not their lived experience, watch that TED Talk. Right. Bring that story into your understanding of the world and start to say, wow, you know, what how does my ability, my disability or my lack of a disability, how does that impact how I move through the world? How I'm understood, right? And then start listening to more stories.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And, I've actually found myself doing that very recently because of I haven't had a lot of interaction with people with disabilities. And so I've sought them out on Twitter, so disability activists and other people on Twitter. So I think that's a great suggestion about whether it's TED Talks, YouTube videos, or following people on social media. The one concern, I think, or question I kind of have about that is, how do we tell what's authentic or representative, or does it matter? You know, you talked about sort of exposure to transgender stories. Some of those are on our cable television stations and reality television shows.
Right.
How should we feel about, well, I don't know, I'm not asking you to tell me how I should feel about it. That's kind of awkward, but, you know, should we be concerned that we're not getting sort of an authentic or representative story, or does it matter?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you do want to consider the source. And first off, always recognize that particularly if you're kind of new to this, kind of starting on a journey of learning about identities and communities that are different, to recognize that the minute you start to get into it, you realize things are tremendously complex. And that can be sometimes challenging. You might have someone who's like, wow, you know, I started to try to talk some about this LGBT stuff, and suddenly I find out that there's like internal infighting, and it's like, yep, welcome to oppressed communities, marginalized communities, right? So one thing is just the more you familiarize yourself, the more you'll start to see some patterns. But the other thing is to kind of think about self-determination. For example, I'm thinking about, let's say I wanted to learn about Native communities. I would look to sources that were connected to people who identify as Native. Now, there might be some people who identify as Native who other Native folks don't see, but don't recognize that way, right? And so that can be complex. There might be, for example, if I use my own community, there are going to be people around LGBTQ identities and communities and politics and ideas that I disagree with, and they're still LGBTQ. So recognizing that we're not a monolith, the Black community is not a monolith, the Latinx community is not a monolith, that there's difference. But what I would be concerned about is listening to a whole lot of white people talk about the experiences of people of color. That I would not trust. Or a lot of the idea like, and this is where we get at the notion of marginality. So if we say, well, we want to talk about gender, so we need to listen equally to men and equally to women. That you could see that argument. Now, I'm going to come back as a feminist and say, well, actually, men have been given tremendous amounts of social and political power. And we see that in our political system, in our economic system, in the fact that almost no institution in this country has at the leadership level higher than 20% women leading it, even nonprofits, even education. So there's been a lot of misogyny and sexism. So am I going to probably give some more weight? And a perfect example might be this whole Me Too movement. Are there going to be cases where someone might falsely accuse someone of sexual assault? Of course. Do I think that's the majority of cases? Not for one moment. And I think there's a really strong reason to understand that. And so I would call on anyone to say, don't just listen to the men on the web, and there are a lot of them out there, who hate feminists, and say, oh, I'm being unbiased. I would say read some feminist analysis, read the people, the psychologists, the people who understand things like repressed memories, and look at scholarly sources, right? You know, and bring a discerning eye to learning about things. And recognize that not everything is about some kind of balance. So I'll just, one more point, a story. I remember having, many years ago when I worked at Metro State University and I was the GLBT director, and I learned this from a gay man who since moved out east, but he used to work it out for a Minnesota LGBT organization. And they had called me up and they said, we want to have someone on Almanac on the Channel 2 show. And we're going to have someone from the Family Family Research Council, which is notoriously anti-GLBT, and then we want you. And I was going to go. And I talked to this person. He said, yeah, they asked me. I won't go. And I said, why? And he goes, because it's not a debate. I'm not willing to entertain the other side that says that homosexuality is evil and morally wrong. Similar to the notion of, well, if we have Black Lives Matter on one side and the Ku Klux Klan on the other, the goal is to find a middle ground. That's not how I approach it. I don't think there's a middle ground. I don't think we want to bring any of what's in the Klan toward where we want to be, because we want liberation and we want equality. And so I think that's helpful, because sometimes when we're seeking out sources, we think unbiased means equal. And if we see that we've never had an equal playing field around the voices of people of color, of Native people, of women, of queer folks, of disabled folks in our media, then to say, well, I listen to this station and this station and I find a middle ground. No, actually all your stations are kind of grounded in this history of oppression. That's my view. And so do I give more weight to the people who live with that marginalized identity? I do. And their analysis.
Anne, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
It's awesome.
You're welcome.
I want to thank you for listening as well. The links to the other podcasts in this series, any of the resources we shared in today's episode, and there was quite a few of them, we'll have those links as well, and a link to more information about cultural competency from Dr. Phibbs and others, all are going to be on our podcast page. You can find it at militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/family-transitions. And you can find out more about Anne Phibbs' work at strategicdi.com. Thanks for listening.
This material is based on work supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy, U.S. Department of Defense Award Number 2015-48770-24368.